Welcome to Udemy Research from our Building a Micro School series by Valor Angles. I'm your host, and today we are tackling something that, I think, keeps every educator and every parent awake at night.
It's a big one.
It's a huge one. This is episode 4 of our 9-part series. And if you've been with us, you know we've already covered the transition to self-directed learning. We've talked about the core models of a micro school. But today
we're getting into the machinery.
Today we are opening the hood to look at the engine. We are talking about the nerves and wires of the operation, the infrastructure of technology.
It is good to be back. And you are so right. This is the topic where the rubber really meets the road. It is where all that beautiful philosophy crashes right into logistics.
Absolutely. And to kick this off, I want to throw some numbers at you. But frankly, when I was reading the prep notes for this, they look like a mistake. I saw a paradox that just made me stop cold.
I have a feeling I know which one you're referring to. It involves a massive contradiction in the data, doesn't it?
It's just glaring. Okay, so let's look at this. On one hand, we have a massive 2025 meta-analysis, mm-hmm. and we're talking over 10,000 children here, that says excessive screen time is associated with an odds ratio of 1.24 for poorer social-emotional development.
Right.
And for hyperactivity. It's even worse, an odds ratio of 1.39. Yeah. So, you know, you look at that and you think, okay, screens are toxic. Throw the tablets in the ocean.
Right. That is the screens are bad narrative. And it's backed by some very large-scale data. It paints a picture of, you know, cognitive decay and behavioral issues.
But then you flip the page to a randomized controlled trial from 2019 by Arfe and colleagues.
A fantastic study.
They took first graders, had them do coding activities for just 1 month, and saw a Cohen's D of 1.62 for executive function development.
Which is a massive effect size. I mean, in the world of educational statistics, a 0.4 is something you celebrate. A 1.62 is just stratospheric.
Exactly. The notes say that 1 month of this specific tech use was equivalent to 7 months of standard development. So we have one statistic saying screens rot your social skills and another saying screens can make you a genius in 4 weeks.
It feels like a contradiction, doesn't it?
It feels like a mess. How can both of these things be true?
But here's the thing. That paradox isn't an error in the data. That paradox is the entire point of this deep dive.
Okay.
The question we are asking today isn't, are screens good or bad? That is a blunt instrument. It's like asking, is food good or bad? Well, are we talking about fresh spinach or are we talking about arsenic?
So we're moving away from the screen time is evil versus tech is the future debate, and we're getting into the weeds.
We have to. If you are building a micro school for children ages 4 to 9, you cannot rely on crude time limits or, you know, just gut feelings. You need an infrastructure plan that is based on evidence, not fear, and definitely not hype.
Right.
The mission of this deep dive is to unpack the specificity when, how and for whom technology works.
I love that. So our goal today is to move beyond the headlines and build a real evidence-based infrastructure plan. We're going to look at the biological foundation, break down the specific evidence of what works and what doesn't, and then finally, we are going to build the protocols for your school.
Precisely. Let's get to it.
Okay, let's unpack this. Section one, the foundation. We have to start with the biology and the psychology of it all. And I want to start with an analogy that really stuck with me from the research. It compares screen time to salt.
Yes. This is the perfect way to visualize the dose and context argument. Think about cooking. Is salt bad for you?
Well, it depends.
Exactly. If you sit down and you eat a cup of salt directly, yes, it will destroy your health. It is literally toxic in that quantity. But a pinch of salt, a pinch enhances the flavor of the entire dish. It brings everything to life.
So the dose matters.
The dose matters. The context matters. You know, are you putting it on fresh vegetables or are you putting it on already processed junk food? And crucially, what it replaces matters.
Right. If you're eating salt instead of drinking water, you're in serious trouble.
Exactly. And technology is the same. A cup of passive, mindless scrolling destroys. A pinch of interactive, creative coding enhances. And this is why we have to define our terms here, because screen time is a meaningless bucket term.
I'm so glad you said that.
It tells you nothing. We need to distinguish between active and passive use.
Okay, let's define those. Because I think most parents, and maybe even some teachers, they just lump them all together. If the screen is on, it counts as screen time. End of story.
And that's a huge mistake. Yeah. So passive screen time is pure consumption. This is watching TV, watching YouTube videos, or, you know, just scrolling through a feed. You are the consumer.
Just taking it in.
Just taking it in. The research, specifically a 2021 study in Frontiers in Psychology, shows that passive watching is negatively related to phonological memory. And that's the ability to process and remember sounds.
And phonological memory is absolutely crucial for learning to read, right?
It's foundational. It is everything. If you can't hold the sound structure of words in your working memory, literacy becomes this massive uphill battle. The passive screen essentially puts the brain in receive-only mode, which doesn't exercise that critical memory loop.
Okay, so passive just is sitting there absorbing. Now, contrast that with active.
Active screen time is interactive. It requires input. This is gaming, this is coding, creating digital art, or using an app that requires you to solve a problem to move forward. You are a procreator, not just a consumer.
Ah, I like that distinction. Procreator.
And that same 2021 study found that interactive touchscreen use showed no negative association with phonological memory.
So wait, one literally hurts a key skill for reading?
Yeah.
And the other is neutral or, you know, maybe even beneficial depending on the activity.
It is night and day. It's the difference between watching a video of someone lifting weights and actually going to the gym and lifting the weights yourself.
That's a great way to put it.
But even with these active screens, we run into biology, especially with the youngest learners. We need to talk about the video deficit effect.
The video deficit effect. It sounds like a bad sci-fi movie. What is it exactly?
It is a very real, very well-documented phenomenon in developmental psychology. Basically, toddlers, and this peaks around 15 months and lasts up to about 30 months, so 2.5 years old. They learn significantly less from screams than they do from live demonstrations.
So if I show a toddler how to stack blocks in real life, they get it. If I show them a video of me doing the exact same thing, stacking blocks, they don't.
They don't get it as well. Sometimes they don't get it at all, even if it is the exact same demonstration, the same person, the same words. And the research is clear on this. This deficit exists even for interactive touch screens for very young children. Their brains just aren't wiring that 2D input to 3D reality yet. It's like a translation error in their cognitive processing.
This connects to another concept in the sources that I found fascinating. It's called social contingency. And this one really explains why some so-called educational shows completely fail to teach anything.
This is the key. This is the key to unlocking learning for young kids. There was a pivotal study by Roseberry and colleagues in 2013, and it was about toddlers learning novel verbs.
New words.
New words. They set up three conditions: a live interaction with a person, a responsive video chat like a Skype or a FaceTime call, and a pre-recorded video of that exact same interaction.
Okay, so in one, the person on the screen can see and hear the toddler and respond in real time. In the other, it's just a recording playing at them.
Correct. And the finding was stark. The toddlers learned the new words via the live interaction, and they learned them via the responsive video chat. But they learned nothing from the pre-recorded video.
Wow, so it wasn't the screen itself that was the barrier. It wasn't the glass.
No.
It was the lack of response.
Precisely. It is all about the contingency. The response from the other party has to be immediate, reliable, and accurate. That back-and-forth social loop is what drives learning, not the glowing rectangle. If the screen responds like a human, learning happens. If it's just broadcasting the toddler's brain, it just tunes it out.
That is a massive insight for anyone building a curriculum. You can't just put a kid in front of a lecture video, no matter how engaging the cartoon character is, and expect magic. The technology has to mimic that social ping pong.
Not at that age, no. It needs to be a dialogue, not a monologue.
Yeah.
And this leads us to what is maybe the most important concept in this entire foundation section, the displacement hypothesis.
This is the idea that screens aren't necessarily, you know, toxic poison in and of themselves, right? It's more about what they're pushing off the table.
Yes. Think about a child's day as a zero-sum game. There are only so many hours. If a child is on a screen for 3 hours, that is 3 hours, they're not doing something else, playing outside, building with Legos, sleeping, or interacting with their parents.
And we have a brand new study from Cambridge University published just this month, January 2026, that really just nails this down. They tracked over 1,000 children for 7 years.
This is a major longitudinal study. It's the kind of research we need more of. They found that screen time before the age of 2 actually altered brain development by the time those kids turned 6.
Altered it how? That sounds terrifying.
We're talking about measurable differences in brain structure, in the white matter tracts that connect different parts of the brain. But, and this is the twist, and it is a huge one, high levels of parent-child reading neutralized these effects.
Wait, neutralized? As in, like, completely, it just went away?
Effectively, yes. The negative correlation between early screen time and later brain development was only present in the kids who were not read to frequently. If the parents were reading to the kids consistently, the negative impact of the screen time on brain development diminished or disappeared entirely.
So what does this tell us? It means the screen wasn't some kind of radioactive material melting their brain. It was just that usually high screen time means low interaction time. But if you keep the interaction, if you keep the reading, you protect the brain.
Exactly. It proves the displacement mechanism. The harm comes when the screen displaces the human connection. If you maintain that vital human connection, the toxicity of the screen is largely managed. It's not about the screen, it's about what the screen takes away.
That is incredibly empowering. It means we aren't helpless victims of technology. We just have to fiercely defend the human interaction.
Which is the perfect segue to looking at the actual evidence of what works and what doesn't.
Let's do it. Let's get into section two, the evidence. We've got the foundation. Now let's look at the specific tools. We've grouped these into three clusters for you. Cluster A is what works. And we have to go back to that coding study I mentioned in the intro. I really want to understand the why behind those incredible numbers.
The RFA 2019 study, this is a favorite of mine because the effect size is just so loud and clear. They took 76 first graders, so, you know, 6 and 7 year olds, and had them engage in block-based coding activities on tablets.
For just 1 month?
1 month. And the result was a Cohen's D of 1.62 for executive function.
Okay, explain that mechanism to me. Why does dragging colorful blocks of code around a screen improve executive function, which is basically our brain's CEO, its self-control, planning, working memory.
Think about what coding, even simple block coding, requires a child to do. You have to plan a sequence of actions before they happen. That's your planning skill.
Okay.
You have to inhibit the urge to just randomly click go until the sequence is logically correct. That's your inhibition or self-control. And when it inevitably doesn't work the first time, you have to find the bug, figure out why it failed, and change your strategy. That's cognitive flexibility.
So it's a workout.
Coding is effectively a high-intensity interval training workout for the prefrontal cortex.
Wow. And that explains the 7 months of growth in 1 month statistic. It's not just about learning a vocational skill like coding. It's actually upgrading the brain's entire operating system.
It is. It's a tool for thinking. And then we have math apps. There's a great study from Uthwaite and colleagues in 2018 with children ages 4 and 5.
This was a pretty big sample size too, right? Nearly 400 kids.
389 children. And they found effect sizes between D0.21 and D0.31. Now, that sounds much smaller than the coding study, but in education, that's a solid, statistically significant finding.
It works.
It works. And the key finding here was that high-quality apps worked, whether they were used to supplement the teacher's instruction or to replace a portion of that instruction. It was effective either way.
So it's not just a toy to keep them busy. It's actual legitimate instruction.
If the app is high quality, that's the important caveat. And finally, for this cluster of things that work, we have the 2024 meta-analysis on blended learning. This is a big one. They looked at 37 different studies and they found that the best outcomes, a standardized mean difference of 0.611, which is very strong, occurred when learning was 60 to 80% technology mediated.
Whoa, hold on. 60 to 80%. That sounds like a lot of tech. That implies the teacher is only doing, what, 20 to 40% of the direct instruction?
It is a significant amount, but notice the two most important things. It's not 100% and it's not 0%. It's that Goldilocks zone, that sweet spot where technology carries the heavy lifting of content delivery or, you know, targeted practice, the rote stuff.
So it frees up the teacher.
It frees up the teacher to focus on high leverage intervention, small group work, Socratic discussion, and emotional support.
So the machine does the drilling and the human does the complex explaining and the relationship building.
Exactly. It frees up the human to be more human.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, so coding works, good math apps work, and this blended learning sweet spot works. Now let's go to the dark side, cluster B, what doesn't work, or at least what lacks solid evidence.
And for that, we have to talk about AI.
The elephant in the room. Everyone is screaming about AI tutors for everyone. It's supposed to be the great equalizer in education.
It is the hype cycle of the decade. But if you actually dig into the research, a 2025 review looked at 50 studies on AI tutoring. Do you want to guess how many of those were in K-12?
Based on the hype, I'd guess a lot. But based on this conversation, I'm guessing not many.
Three
out of 50.
Just three. The vast majority were on university students, and we are taking data from college kids who have fully developed executive function and study skills, and we are assuming it just magically applies to kindergartners who are still learning to tie their shoes. That is a dangerous leap of faith.
What about that Stanford Tutor Copilot study. I saw that making headlines everywhere, a big success story for AI in lower grades.
It did, and it did show gains about 4 to 9 percentage points in math scores. But, and this is a huge but that gets buried in the press release, the AI didn't replace the teacher. It assisted human tutors.
How did it assist them?
It was like a little coach in their ear. It would analyze the student's work and give prompts to the adult tutor on how to help the student. It was a tool for the adult, not a direct tutor for the child.
That is a crucial distinction. The AI was a coach for the coach, not a tutor for the student.
Exactly. The human was still the primary point of contact. And we also must mention the conflict of interest problem here. A lot of these studies are run by the vendors themselves. Khan Academy studying Khan Academy, Google studying Google.
Right.
It doesn't mean the data is fake, but we have to view it with a healthy dose of skepticism. Independent third-party verification is still very scarce in this area.
Speaking of skepticism, let's talk about some of the micro-school claims out there. We've seen reports from places like Alpha School claiming students are hitting 99th percentile scores with just 2 hours of work a day.
These are incredibly bold claims, but again, you have to ask, where is the peer-reviewed data? These are vendor reports, not independent studies. And we've seen the backlash, like the so-called snack controversy.
Oh, I read about this. This was the AI-first model where kids were allegedly denied snacks if they didn't meet their productivity goals set by the algorithm.
Right. And whether it happened exactly that way or not, it points to a danger. When you hand over pedagogical authority to an algorithm, you risk creating a very punitive, rigid environment. No snack until you finish your modules is not a pedagogical strategy. It is a recipe for anxiety.
Wow.
It prioritizes machine efficiency over a child's well-being.
It sounds like a dystopian novel. So the bottom line is AI is promising, but largely unproven for this 4 to 9 age group. And vendor claims need a giant grain of salt.
Correct. For now, it's more hype than reality for our audience.
Which brings us to our final evidence cluster, Cluster C, the multiplier. If some tech works and some doesn't, what's the secret ingredient? What's the variable?
The variable is the adult. We call this the adult mediation multiplier.
The human in the loop.
Always. The human is not a bug. They're a feature. Look at the IST 2011 study on teacher training. It showed an 85% implementation rate of new tech when teachers received coaching and support.
Okay, 85%. What was the rate without coaching?
Just 15%.
Wow.
You can buy all the Chromebooks you want, but if you don't coach the humans on how to use them to actually teach, they become very expensive paperweights.
And this applies to parents too, right? At home.
Absolutely. The research on co-viewing is really clear. That's where a parent sits with the child and watches a show or plays a game with them. That simple act transforms potentially harmful screen time into powerful learning time.
How so?
It turns the passive into the active. The parent is asking questions. What do you think will happen next? They're pointing things out. Look, that's a hexagon like the one we saw at the park. They're making connections to the real world. The adult's presence is the multiplier.
So the summary of all the evidence is this. The technology doesn't replace the human. The human makes the technology work.
That is the bumper sticker for this entire deep dive.
I love it. Okay, we've got the theory. We've got the evidence. Now let's get our hands dirty.
Yeah.
Section 3. Application. If I'm a founder listening to this, how do I actually build this infrastructure? We have 4 protocols for you.
Protocol 1 is the minimum viable tech stack.
Minimum being the key word here, I'm guessing.
Simplicity is your absolute best friend. A typical school district might use, and this is a real number, 10,000 different digital products across all their schools. It is utter chaos. A micro school should aim for 4 to 6 core tools.
That's it. 4 to 6.
That is all you need to start. You must avoid tool sprawl. It kills your budget. It fragments your data. It burns out your teachers and it ruins your focus.
Okay, what about hardware? What are we actually buying?
You have to look at the market reality. Chrome OS has over 60% of the K-12 market share in the US, and a recent survey showed 93% of districts plan to buy them. The ecosystem is built around them.
Why is it so dominant? Is it just because they're cheap?
Price is part of it for sure, but the real reason is operational simplicity. They now have a 10-year automatic update policy. For a micro school founder who is also the principal and the teacher and probably the janitor.
And the IT department.
And the IT department, you do not have time to be a troubleshooter. You need things that just work.
So Chromebooks are the standard recommendation.
Manage Chromebooks for ages 7 to 9. For the younger ones, the 4 to 7 crowd, you want a touch-first interface. Keyboards are a huge barrier for a 5-year-old. Touch is intuitive. So for them, you're looking at either a managed iPad or a touchscreen Chromebook.
You said managed a couple of times. This brings us to a specific acronym you told me was absolutely non-negotiable, MDM.
MDM, Mobile Device Management. This is software that allows you to control all of your school's devices from one central dashboard.
Why is this non-negotiable? Can't I just hand the kids the iPads and, you know, trust them?
If you do that, you have lost control of your school. MDM handles policy enforcement, so kids can't access websites or apps they shouldn't. It handles security for shared devices. It lets you push the apps you want to every device at once, so you don't have to manually install them on 20 screens.
I see.
If you don't have an MDM, you don't have an infrastructure. You have a pile of expensive, unsecured toys.
Loud and clear. MDM.
Okay. Okay.
Protocol 2, age-specific allocation. How much time are we actually talking about here? The dose.
We need to be very intentional here based on the developmental science. For ages 4 to 6, the absolute maximum should be 60 minutes a day. And it should be center-based.
What do you mean center-based?
I mean, they go to a tech station to do a specific activity for 15 or 20 minutes, then they leave. It shouldn't be a one-to-one device they carry around all day. We have to remember the video deficit effect. Their brains need rich 3D physical world interaction.
Right. The brains need to touch and feel and move.
Exactly. Now, for the older group, ages 7 to 9, you can go up to 120 minutes a day. This is where those blended learning ratios we talked about can really come into play. But the focus should shift heavily towards creation, writing documents, coding, making presentations, creating things.
And we have to balance all of this with physical activity.
It's the displacement trade-off again. It's always there. The official guidelines are 180 minutes of physical activity per day for ages 2 to 5, that's 3 hours, and 60 minutes of moderate to vigorous activity for older kids. If your screen time policy eats into that, you are failing the child's basic physiology.
Got it. Okay, protocol 3. This is the scary stuff. This is compliance.
It is not optional. It's the law. And there are two big ones that every microschool founder needs to have on their radar right now.
First up, COPPA 2025 amendments. Let's spell that out. COPPA.
Right, COPPA. The Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. The new amendments are effective in June 2025. And the big change, it requires separate explicit parental consent for AI training.
Separate consent. What does that mean in practice?
It means you can't just bury it in a 40-page terms of service agreement that nobody reads. Parents have to explicitly check a box or sign something that says, yes, I consent to my child's data being used to train your AI model.
Wow.
And here's the kicker. The definition of personal information now officially includes voice prints.
Voice prints. So if a kid is talking to an AI reading tutor,
that audio of their voice is now considered biometric data. It is personally identifiable information, and it is protected under federal law.
That is huge. Microschool founders need to know exactly what their software is doing with that data. You can't just assume the app you downloaded is safe or compliant.
Absolutely not. You have to ask the vendor for a data privacy agreement. And the second big one is WCAG.
WCAG.
Spelled W-C-A-G. It stands for Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. The Department of Justice released a new rule in April 2024. The deadline is April 2026 for large entities and April 2027 for small schools.
And what does it require?
It requires that all your digital content, your website, your learning materials, the apps you use, your parent communications, everything must meet the WTCAG 2.1 Level AA standard for accessibility.
So it has to be usable by people with disabilities.
Correct. People who are blind, deaf, have motor impairments. This isn't a nice to have feature anymore. It is a legally mandated civil right, and the clock is ticking.
April 2027 for small schools. That feels far away, but it's really not when you're building an entire infrastructure from scratch. Trying to retrofit that later sounds like an absolute nightmare.
It will be. It will be incredibly expensive and difficult. You have to build for accessibility from day one.
Okay, that leads us to protocol 4. Content selection.
Yeah.
How do we actually pick the good apps and avoid the bad ones? You have a framework called the 4 pillars.
This is a great lens to use to cut through all the marketing hype. Pillar 1, active learning. Does the app require manipulation and construction? Or is the kid just passively watching or tapping?
Right. Active versus passive. We've established that one.
Got it. Pillar 2, engagement. Is the engagement in the learning task itself? Does it give relevant feedback? Or is it just a bunch of distracting bells and whistles? A lot of so-called educational games are just chocolate-covered broccoli.
Chocolate-covered broccoli. I am definitely stealing that. I love that imagery.
The kid has to eat the gross broccoli, the math problem, to get the chocolate, the little cartoon that dances. They distract the kid with noises and colors that have nothing to do with the actual learning. The learning itself should be the engaging part, not the confetti cannon that goes off after.
Pillar 3.
Meaningful learning. Does it connect to their lived experience? Does it build on what they already know? Or is it just a series of disconnected abstract facts?
And the last one.
Pillar 4. Social interaction. The best tech facilitates collaboration. Can two kids use it together? Does it prompt conversations between the child and the teacher? It shouldn't be an isolating experience.
And I remember a warning you gave in the prep notes about free apps. This seems really important.
Yes. The research shows that free apps scored significantly lower on these four pillars than paid apps. And the reason is simple. Monetization.
Yeah.
Ads, pop-ups, constant upsells to buy the full version. They're monetized by distraction. And you have to remember the rule. If you aren't paying for the product, your child's attention is the product.
That is a chilling but necessary reminder for anyone in education.
It is almost always worth paying a few dollars for the clean, effective, focused tool.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground. I mean, from the paradox of screen time all the way to the nuts and bolts of MBMs and copia laws.
It is a lot, but it is manageable. It's totally manageable if you have a clear plan.
So let's wrap this up. Let's bring it back to the mission we set at the start. What are the key actionable takeaways for the founder listening right now who's feeling a little overwhelmed?
I would boil it all down to three things. Three main principles. First, mode over minutes.
Mode over minute.
Stop obsessing solely on the clock. It's not the most important metric. Focus on what the child is doing. Is it active or passive? Is it creation or consumption? Active engagement with adult mediation beats passive consumption every single time.
Mode over minutes. Check. What's number two?
Second, simple stack. Do not go out and buy 40 different apps. You need a base of reliable hardware Chrome OS or iPads, a solid MDM, and maybe 6 core high-quality tools. That is it. Operational simplicity is your best friend when you're starting out.
Keep it simple. Got it. Check.
And third, compliance is concrete. COPIA and WCAG dates are real. April 2026, April 2027. These aren't suggestions. They are legal deadlines. Build your privacy and accessibility standards into your school's DNA right now before the lawyers come knocking.
That's incredibly solid advice. And it leads me to a closing the technology question. It isn't really about whether we should use screens or not. It feels much deeper than that after this conversation.
It is. It's about building an infrastructure that enhances learning without displacing the things that make us human. Play. Human interaction. Exploration and physical world. If the tech supports that, it's a tool, it's infrastructure. If it replaces that, it's interference.
If it replaces that, it's interference. I'm gonna write that down. Thank you so much for helping us navigate this this digital minefield today.
My pleasure. It is the most important infrastructure we will build for the next generation.
And for you listening, thank you for diving deep with us. You can find the full research, the citations for the ARFE study, the Cambridge study, and all the legal details at research.uda.me. That's yuda.me.
Please dig into the sources. The details really, really matter on this topic.
Absolutely. Next up in the Building a Microschool series, we'll look at episode 5, where we tackle the financial model. We're going to talk tuition, budgets, and how to build a sustainable school. You will not want to miss that. Until then, keep building.